Welcome to the Feudal Podcast. You can get information from the Feudal Podcast, check out our show notes, and download the MP3s at... go to our website at www.graniteseed.com/futilepodcast if you want to check out the show notes for these this podcast or get any other ones on MP3. You should also be able to find us if you search Futile Podcast, one word. On iTunes.
Where else are these being?
They're on iTunes and they're on the website. Okay, so tonight we're going to do a review of...
Electric Light and Blue.
Indeed. Little Robert Beretta...
Blake.
Who some might know as, I guess, a murderer that got off. Allegedly. You know, he didn't allegedly get off.
Chappelle Show.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Beretta did that shit.
This movie, do you know the date on it? I didn't check. I think it was 70-something.
Early 70s.
Yeah.
71, 72.
The director was a composer who managed the band Chicago. Was nominated for a bunch of Grammys for his studio work and stuff. He worked with U2 and a whole bunch of other groups. And the only movie he ever directed is this movie. And the style, there's a little opening in the DVD that where he talks about a few things about like the theme of the movie and sort of what he thinks sort of that was based on this real life event, sort of, which is probably pretty loose. I don't know. I didn't do the research.
That was something I wasn't aware of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just as simple as, hey, an incident like that. But,
Oh, and it was made in 1973.
1973, that's what I thought, yeah. The visual style is interesting. The director talks about working with a camera operator who was coming away from years of doing stuff in this sort of John Ford big open huge depth of field fantastic like nature cinematography approach.
Conrad,
that was the name of the director of photography. And the director had grown up watching all these old Ford movies, so one of his favorite was The Searchers, which everybody listening to the podcast hopefully has seen or should see. But it's one of the famous, famous John Wayne, John Ford movies.
It's not my favorite.
It's got the doorway shot and a lot of other things that film scholars will talk about a lot. But it's known very explicitly for its... it's cinematography, the CinemaScope, the huge sweeping valleys and the giant rocks and the color and the richness of the tones and everything. Definitely something that's very beautiful. It's almost like, why would you shoot something any other way than that if you're shooting that subject? It's kind of like a foregone conclusion. And the director really...
Well, it really depended on what you were trying... Well, The Searchers was a really interesting movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, the kidnapping and all that crap. And so it was a little bit darker in a way. But, I mean, a lot of those movies really romanticized the Old West and really had nothing to do with the West. But the whole point of that was those great landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Western started really changing around the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, you got into the revisionist Westerns, and then Clint Eastwood, which, you know, obviously, like, Unforgiven is considered the paramount of that in 1992.
And it was shot a lot differently.
Mm-hmm.
And it was grittier.
That's the term.
Yeah, that pretty much. And they got away from that a little bit, but I was just thinking about The Outlaw Josie Wales, and... there were still some grand themes in that.
Yeah, I think for me, it's more just, even if you're telling a dark story, which this movie is on a large level, the environment is is what it is. And so, you know, you can change it with filters and you can, you know, make it look like traffic or something.
I definitely dig the sepia tones.
Yeah, the sepia tones are cool. In a few places, they just use it.
And it looked like they were using some sort of wide-angle lens a little bit, too.
CinemaScope, yeah. They were really trying to get as panoramic as they could.
But in some scenes, it was definitely a little blurred and a little rounded at the edges.
Yeah, it's just an optic distortion and all that. But they kept the gritty inside. And that was the thing, is that the director compromised with his director of photography and said, look, I want these beautiful, huge panoramic, because that's what that environment is. And even if you're telling a dark story, then you're juxtaposing it with this beautiful landscape. And it's almost more effective because you're not trying to... To me, it seems like using tricks, like using gimmicks like filters and a lot of things to artificially grittify an environment, it sort of shows your hand too early or something. I think that beautiful images set to horrific events or whatnot are somewhat more powerful. And I mean, I'm thinking of like the Thin Red Line, where I mean, essentially it's a tropical paradise, but these guys are fighting a war in the midst of it.
Cuba is a tropical paradise.
Yeah.
But no, I see what you're saying. I mean, you could say the same thing about Europe and all these beautiful architectural masterpieces.
Yeah, Dresden, you know? Dresden. Exactly. Yeah.
But anyway, war is hell.
Indeed. And this is sort of a post-war reflection to a degree. It's post-Vietnam, 73. No, yep. Not even.
Pretty close. Pretty close. It was coming to a close.
It was coming to a close. And it brings up
Nixon
the issue.
Nixon was almost gone.
It brings up that issue. It brings up
Agnew
the idea.
Agnew was already gone.
The idea of veterans and and hippies and people. What are they going to do when they get back? To a level. It talks about it quickly and it doesn't spend... It's not about that necessarily, but it is an aspect that the theme is maybe toying.
You know, it was kind of interesting. His character was kind of a dickhead across the board in the beginning. Didn't matter if you were a cop.
No.
Didn't matter if you were a bum.
Yeah, or a hippie or whatever. And the thing about it, and we'll get back to that maybe when we get to the end, is his statement to the guy, which is to me seems like a very, very kind of, I guess the French didn't like it. But it was the Cannes, it went to Cannes in 73, and I guess the director said that it was viewed as being a very fascist movie, which I think it kind of, it is not on the side of the counterculture, which is probably a little odd.
It's
something
not
like,
on the side of the authority either.
No, it's not, though. And so I think in order, maybe at the time, in order to gain success, you have to be on the side of the counterculture. It's sort of...
You could go a lot of different directions.
Yeah,
the
themes in this movie are pretty much... It's about authority, and it's about the judicious, appropriate use of authority. One of the detectives in the movie, Harv, who is...
Played by Mitchell.
I don't know.
I always think of him as the general from Lethal Weapon, but his name is...
That is the general from Lethal Weapon, huh?
It is.
McAllister?
It's McAllister.
That's awesome. Didn't that guy also play Greg's dad in Dharma and Greg?
I don't know.
Weird.
I didn't.
I have to review my DVDs of Dharma and Greg at home that I have at home. So McAllister, who's playing a different character, his name's Harv, has a line in the movie about a third of the way in where it's just like, incompetence is the worst form of corruption, and that's great because when you're talking about people that are in positions of authority, that really is very important. It's just the willful disregard for proper procedure, proper police procedure.
Billy Greenbush, the guy who plays Zippo, he was also the dad in Critters, if you'd forgotten that.
Oh, I completely forgot
about
Critters.
But he's not a bad... He definitely did a lot.
No, he was good in this. He was simple. I would say that most of the acting in this was really good.
Yeah,
really good. I mean, that scene with the woman being drunk is kind of a melodramatic scene.
Which was the point,
and it sort of happened just to create the rift between John, Big John and Harv.
Well, no, I thought the whole point was really to show that Harv,
yeah,
wasn't always in touch with reality.
He wasn't the king shit all the time, yeah.
No, he wasn't. And it really put him in his place. And that allowed you had to put it really, that's what really started, because before that point, he had been on a roll. Yeah. He'd been right about a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Blake's character was getting drawn into that.
He was apprenticed to him, pretty much, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, well, let's get ourselves
it was
back.
Also, there was a conflict there.
Yeah,
and I am trying to make a point with this.
No.
And it's one of those, it's just one of those great moments, because it's one of those five or six stories that just get retold over and over.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just a great moment, because even though it was it's a cult classic, and it was an independent film for the time. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a pretty well-financed independent film.
Well, $1 million for 73.
Well, that'd be like, what, $10 million now?
It'd be quite a bit. Yeah, that's a good budget. Lucas made American Graffiti for $750 2 years later. So there gives you a sense of it. And, you know, they had some pyrotechnics, they had some car chases in this movie, or motorcycle chases.
The special effects weren't the best.
Special effects weren't bad for the time.
Okay.
I didn't have any problems with them, and I'm usually pretty good at that. I mean, the blood looked a little bit like the red paint blood they used in the 70s.
I think there was a point to that, because it was considered a Western, but the whole point
with
the Harf thing was simply that the movie is obviously about Robert Blake's character and his growth as a person, and he's a single. I'm assuming he's supposed to be in his early 30s. And
takes good care of himself.
And he's got dreams. And his major dream that he takes care of himself. But his dream just got shit on. And his dream is in the hands of this detective, Harf.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an inner struggle with himself, because Harf is doing things he doesn't believe in.
Yeah.
But he doesn't act on it. And there was a great moment where, which is, it's really, the great thing about this movie, I thought, was there are moments where you don't really, you switch sides.
You switch sides, I was just going to say that, yeah.
Because the counterculture can be dickheads, and the authority can be dickheads, and you really just don't root for anybody, but you see this poor guy who's trying to be, he's trying to live ethically, or he's trying to
by his principles.
He's trying to live by his principles, and he's in conflict, which a lot of people can understand, because if you want to succeed, a lot of times you end up having to cow to people you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do things you don't want to do, and it's just part of life. You know, it might be as simple as going and picking up coffee for people or doing other shit, but you know, as Montgomery Burns would say, you bide your time and you climb the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was the whole focus, really the main story to me, and everything else was really,
it was
on
the theme,
periphery.
According to the director, is about this one guy who was just going to stick to his guns and went by his principles and negotiate these situations.
But he didn't for a while. He compromised his principles.
Well, he was learning.
As soon as he went back to him,
mm-hmm.
he solved the case. Things didn't work out well for him, which was another interesting point of the 70s. I think we talked a little bit about last time.
Yeah.
When we went off on a tangent then. But that's just the beauty of the 70s movies, was, I guess just because they were allowed to all of a sudden, there was a real string of unhappy endings.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was post-Watergate, post Vietnam, everyone was in a bad fucking mood, and everyone had an axe. They had an axe to grind with the authorities, with the establishment, with their own kind. Even, you know, with the drug
culture was hit,
the drug culture was coming up, and coke and everything was getting.
But that had really stopped the country. I mean, it's when people start talking about specific time periods, the country had been through a lot.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
The 20th century was, but then it's like, there are really only these windows of maybe 10 years, if you're lucky, of tranquility. It's a story about a man, but it's also a reflection of society, which is what makes it so entertaining.
Well, American Society. I think American that's why the frogs society. Probably didn't like it so
fuck
much.
Them anyway.
Because it's about it's about an individual.
They're all going to be speaking Farsi in like 50 years anyway.
Very likely.
And I don't want to offend anybody.
Well, it all kind of led up to it. I mean, if you think about it,
it really did.
73 was the first break in some ways. It wasn't even a break, but it was like you have your financial situation, you have World War One, you have the Great Depression, you have World War Two, you have Korea, you have Vietnam, then you have 1970.
We had all these assassinations.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the civil rights movement. And this blows me away. You had federal troops occupying American cities. In the 60s, you had the National Guard firing live rounds on students in American universities. These things had never happened before. I mean, it's just totally, utterly bizarre. And if you read about it, you would automatically think like Czechoslovakia, or you'd think about some other Mexico City or some other shithole where the establishment puts their thumb on the people. Not the United States of America. The country was really, really fucked up. Things had really come to a head. I mean, they really started to go in the 60s, but by 73, it was really the end of the 60s.
Yeah, definitely. That whole period it was going on. And the hippie culture had started to change from its peace and love to, you know, guys running barbiturates and things. They had to make money. And so this is about a cop who deals with laws.
Yep.
And it starts great. Close shots of people, of someone doing something, of a hand grabbing a shotgun shell, tying a string to a toe.
The director really let the cinematographer...
He let him do what he wanted inside, which was be grittier and be darker. It's got... I mean, honestly, I'm sure that pre-73, that some of these revisionist westerns had come in. I know Peckinpah had started doing some of his stuff earlier than that. But this sort of visual aesthetic with the harsh, dark shadows, even like in a bar when they're playing pool and stuff, and the visual aesthetic of those places are very different than a traditional Western, and even than your traditional movie, for the time. So I'd say this movie probably has won over on a few in terms of its gritty approach, but the way that it does both is so great, because it all the exteriors, you've got the John Ford sweeping landscapes, the wide depth of field, but in the interiors you've got the dark, gritty, you know, approach to the visuals, and that's just great. And so the beginning of the movie starts dark and gritty, close-ups, but it's brown tones and things that are more traditionally Western tones, because it's out in the woods. I mean, you wouldn't imagine,
putting a patina on the film.
Yeah, even though you're looking at close-ups of images and stuff, it would be like a science fiction movie if this, after watching this scene, somebody like walked outside of this like room where this is happening, and it was like in the middle of a like bustling, like sprawled out city or something. It would be like, what? No, you know that it's taking place in the desert, even without knowing that yet, almost. Which is great, just in the way that they do it with subtle details and all that. So basically, guys frying up some pork chops, doing something with a shotgun shell and a string.
They look good.
And then, boom, they look a little dry, actually, when you cut into them. But pork is tough to get right.
Well, you gotta. The thing was, if you're going to do that, you have to have the thicker ones.
Yeah, I know.
And really, you should use an electric frying pan and then have a lid over it.
You want to
and
cover
then just
it for sure.
Brown them with that.
Definitely.
But damn, that sounds good.
Anywho, so the shotgun goes off, and you think, oh, this guy just commits suicide with tying a string to a shot, you know, to a shotgun on his toe. But then, like, well, wait, the guy, somebody's eating a piece of pork chop. And you're like, oh. okay.
Well, at that point, you pretty much know.
You pretty much know it's a murder. Yeah, you know that it's a murder.
Because maybe that's not what the story was about. It wasn't a murder mystery story.
Not really, but there is a bit of detective work that happens in it that gives you that sort of crime story aspect that allows you to kind of easily put it in a genre to a level, because the more abstract idea of one individual man's like attempt to reconcile the differences in between like authoritarian approach to things and this sort of freewheeling hippie approach, which is also just as fraught with corruption and crime, it needs a structure, and the structure is them trying to solve this murder. And that's happened in a bunch of stories before. Most crime stories, that's what that's about. That's what a film noir usually is. It's a guy that is neither a 100% authority, nor is he 100% crime. He's the hard-boiled detective. He's the private eye that knows both sides and works with both sides. And, I mean, in this case, Blake is presented from the beginning. You know, you get a shot of an American flag at his place. He's making time with some woman, and then he's, you know, exercising and all that. So this shows that he's this character with a lot of, you know, strength. He's got a lot of virility.
Well, he's got to. He's a little guy.
He's a little guy, yeah. Maybe he's got a short man complex. Who knows? But he's little and he's tough. And then he gets all geared up, and they show with close-ups of him getting his gun on and everything, and putting the leathers on because he's a bike cop. And that's an awesome scene. Just the way
also one of my favorite scenes. The scenes with no dialogue.
Yeah.
That scene, I also equate that scene as the beginning, and it's big,
mm-hmm.
and it's right in his face,
mm-hmm.
and he's taking on the world.
Yeah.
He's standing there ready to march out, and he's going to conquer the world.
Yeah, yeah.
The world is huge, and he's just this little tiny speck.
Yeah, there is a definite sort of difference in the two. There is a bookending to that that makes that point. I agree with you there. He's a motorcycle cop riding around, busting people when they go too fast, when they break the law. You know, if they don't have a bumper on their car, you know, he's by the book, and the first person that he busts is some guy that looks like Ron Burgundy, but that guy's an L.A. detective. That means big deal. We're from big league, not Bush League. None of this Cracker Barrel bullshit.
I think, Los Angeles Police Department had taken some hits right around that time.
I would imagine so. But the point is that this guy, thinks he doesn't deserve a ticket for going 30 over the speed limit because he's a cop, like the unwritten rules of the road or something, you know, wink, wink. Probably one of the bigger reasons that people hate cops in the first place is because it becomes some fucking fraternity of, hey, I let you get away with it and you let me get away with it and we'll just do our own thing.
Well, you know, in a way, and I've always been irritated by this also because, yes, it's a difficult job, but the people that do it generally get off on it and they do it because they love it.
Hey, you know what? No one's forcing you.
But at the same time, it's just one of those just agreements that it's like, okay, this is really if you work in a movie theater,
mm-hmm.
you get to see free movies.
In the theater?
You work at Mickey D's, you get a free quarter pounder with uh-huh. cheese. Maybe even some fries and a shake.
Maybe you get a free haircut if you're
and
a cop.
And an apple pie.
You get a free cup of coffee at the Dunkin' Donuts.
Well, you know, you can't push that.
No, you don't want to.
State has rules.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in any government position, there's rules on gratuity.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with vendors.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between loyalty, I think, and just this guy was bold-faced. Like, you could tell he was a prick.
Was an asshole.
He was a approach, and he was 30 over. I'm sure it was the middle of the desert, but, I mean, come on.
But, I mean, but the point of that was just that he dealt justice with an even hand, and he had his principles, which he compromised because he wanted to be a big shot.
Yeah, we'll get into this. So, first one, it's a cop. The cop gives him, the detective, this LA detective, gives him this like huge spiel of how he's going to get him back, bust anyone that got Arizona
license
plates.
Which I've heard there's some truth to.
But that, so there
because
you go.
I've heard of stories like that.
And you know what? It does not faze Big John. They call him Big John because he's small. John Wintergreen, that's our main character, played by Mr. Robert I'm a Murderer Blake.
Well, he was acquitted.
Yeah, he was acquitted. We already talked about that. I'm just kidding. Anywho, so the next person that they show him busting is this this
it big... It wasn't rig. A mistrial, was it?
I don't remember.
Okay.
It was this big rig. And he busts him basically because...
Man, that's a weird-looking dude.
It's too big of a rig to be on that given road.
That guy just looked like he was a serial killer.
Well, who knows what he was. But there was a good chance that the guy might have had something in that cargo.
Well, I'm telling you, he just lost his third job in a row. Mm-hmm. He's going to go on a spree.
And he's a vet. They bring up the Vietnam thing there.
All the more reason to go on a spree.
But he's clearly trying to kind of spin all of this to get sympathy from Wintergreen. And Wintergreen is like, yeah.
But no. Then at the same time, Wintergreen...
had been there, too.
Well, he...
He was a Marine.
It. He doesn't provoke it, but he instigates the story. He stands there. He's like, tell me your story.
Yeah. He wants to hear how the guy's... What the guy's opinion of it is. Because honestly, he helps him. Like he said, he wants to help him, and he does. By not helping him.
Stop doing stupid shit like driving down a road with a tractor trailer that he knows he's not supposed to go down.
Yeah.
But then you wonder. You wonder if he knew... I mean, he only been working the job for
Here's
a while.
Here's the deal, though. Even if he didn't know, do you think he's going to forget now that he's actually been punished?
Do you think he's going to learn anything that he just lost his fucking job?
He didn't lose a job because of that. He just was an inconvenience for him. That was the whole point.
He said he's going to lose this job because it was going to make him...
Later?
He's going to be late.
Well, maybe he'd lose the job and then he would have to get a new one, but he would learn the lesson.
Hopefully,
yeah. You can't force anything on anybody. But Wintergreen even makes the point. I'm going to give you some that took me 6 months to get, which is nothing. I'm not gonna pity you, and I'm not gonna baby feed you. I'm gonna put you in a position where you know you have to do your own thing. And sure, some people probably see it as it makes him a dick and it makes him a prick. But you know, it's tough love. What do you want to say? And then the next one, they show him meet up with his buddy Zipper, your buddy, Greenbush. And Zipper loves to sit in the shade, as he calls it, which is not the shade. It's just he parks his bike on the side of the road, and he's a fellow motorcycle cop, and he reads comic books. And
he's especially partial to Wonder Woman, and so am I.
So then they fix to go bust this this hippie van.
Which really fascinates me, and I brought it up again. But that has got to be one of the very first VW buses.
73?
I don't know. This thing looked like it was from the late 50s, maybe early
60s. Oh, well, so it was an old one at the time.
It was an old one. It had a split windshield.
It's all painted.
I mean, if you looked at it, you'll never see one of those around here.
Probably not. Well, maybe around here. Maybe in Humboldt County.
And all the ones I see around here are a lot newer than that.
Okay, well.
Not that they're new, but that one was freaking ancient.
So, then... in the process of this, we're seeing, okay, ooh, now it's, here we go. We're going to bust the hippie. They're looking for something on him. Zipper is much more gung-ho about the whole thing. He's more like, hey, clear out your shit. We want to look through all of it. You know, I mean, there's no, they never really give a sense of what their, like, rationale is for search and seizure.
But in a certain, they're profiling.
Yeah. They definitely are. Hmm. But the approach... From Wintergreen is you know, he gets the guy's license, he, you know, calls him by his name, he's very personable with the guy for the most part, and just kind of amuses his partner to allow this search, which takes a while, and spews all the stuff out. And then his partner is like, hey, check in there, and then Wintergreen's like, well, I already checked there. And he's like, no, well, maybe just double check it. Like, clearly it's obvious that the partner planted some stuff, hoping, just because he's game to bust this guy, because he has a bug up his ass about him being kind of a wise-ass hippie. And Wintergreen's like, you know what, no. We're going to clean this stuff up, and we're going to, you know. And they have a little bit of a confrontation there, but it becomes apparent that Wintergreen is not only is he by the book, but he's not one of these by-the-book squares that's going to bust a hippie just because he's a long hair.
He's not like that. No, he's going to bust somebody if they break the law.
If they do it wrong. If they break the law, if they do it wrong, then for the most part, he's going to bust them. You know, pretty stringent.
But, and that's the... Well, okay.
We'll get to that later, for sure. So now, we basically start getting into Wintergreen's character, which is, he goes out and has a couple beers with his buddy Zipper, his partner. They're shooting pool and stuff. And it becomes apparent that Wintergreen... and he's mentioned this before to his superior, to his sergeant and everything, that he wants to get into homicide. He wants to he does not like the life of being a motorcycle cop. He wants to become a detective.
In his own words, he wants to get paid to think and not be paid to get calluses on his ass.
Exactly. Basically, he ends up stumbling onto the crime scene of this suicide, and because Elijah Cook, who anyone would know from a lot of, he was in bazillions of old film noirs. He was always sort of like the third henchman lackey guy, kind of big wide eyes, is this crazy guy that they know that they end up tracking down and finding when he's running around one day and they're driving by. And he tells them, oh, go, there's something happened at Frank's shack or whatever. And so they go, and he finds the body there, and he calms himself down, and he takes some notes, and then the coroner comes in, and the whole scene with the coroner is great. Because the coroner's basically looking to write this off as a suicide, but Wintergreen, who has his own motives.
He's over budget.
Yeah, has his own motives. He wants this to be like a case. Even though it's a suicide, or it looks like a suicide, but he's got the facts on his side.
Well, he did honestly have a couple of interesting points.
Yeah.
Why would you shoot yourself with a shotgun in the chest?
Why would you shoot yourself with a shotgun in the chest and risk and suffer bleeding to death? He knew about the pork chops. You know, he thought, you know, we could go to the lab and test. This is 73, and Wintergreen.
And I'm trying to figure out what the. No, that's just bullshit. Because, like the coroner said, who gives a fuck when the pork chops died?
Well, but you can.
I don't understand.
You would be able to determine like at what point they were cooked, possibly, and then you could compare that to the time of death and be like, these pork chops were either cooked exactly at the time, and
but,
here's the other thing,
but,
it's even simpler, if it had a bite taken out of it, in the autopsy, is there a pork chop in the stomach of the guy? Why would you? I mean, the whole thing is like I said, that's how you know at the beginning as a viewer that it's not a suicide, because not only does somebody.
I don't know how big forensic. I mean, this isn't fucking CSI.
I know, but the point is that in 73, Wintergreen was thinking that way.
Wintergreen, like you said, had his own motives.
Yep, the facts were on his side. You know, the shotgun to the chest was big.
And the facts could easily not been on his side.
But they were in the movie.
Yeah, they were on Harv's side, too, and Harv was an asshole.
Yeah, but they were both on the same page about this one thing.
I mean, it's like, look at the intuition. I'm going to cut ahead really quick, but the Jesus statue. And you could read into that a whole bunch. But that, looking for something that doesn't belong, that's one of those moments where you're like, this guy's got an uncanny sense about him, and he must really know what he's doing. And ultimately, he didn't.
Well, no. I mean, he did. He did and he didn't, is what you got to say. He missed something.
And you could say the same thing about Wintergreen.
He's human. I know, and I am. But I'm saying that in terms of his character, wanting to be a homicide guy, you know it's not just a pipe dream because of all the things he mentions in the scene with the coroner. Because he likes
all the
crimes.
When do we get to talk about when it all comes crashing down?
It all comes crashing down pretty quickly after this. Basically, the high... what's his name shows up?
Harv.
Harv shows up as the big deal detective. And he notices that Wintergreen like, is the only one that's on the ball about it. And so it kind of takes him under his wing. So it's like, I need a new driver. Basically... For a while there,
it makes you wonder what happened to the old driver. Though
he becomes, I think, sodomized to death by Harv because he's a vile pig.
Well, I hadn't quite thought about that, but I was thinking maybe there was a personnel issue.
I'm definitely sure that there was something.
Maybe the
he graduated out of
maybe
it.
Maybe that driver fucked his girlfriend too.
He graduated out of it. Anywho, so now Wintergreen and Harv are buddies, and Harv is passing on his information about being a detective. He's kind of cocky. He's kind of arrogant. But, you know, so for the most part, you see that he seems to know his shit. And you're right. He does know his shit. And they get some fingerprints, and they hunt down a guy.
That's the part that keeps you guessing.
Yeah, exactly. But they get some fingerprints in the, of this guy, and so they go looking for him. And they found...
Zebko.
They find some barbiturates at Frank's place. Something that didn't belong inside of the Jesus statue, like you said. Harv just looked around for something that didn't belong, and in his mind, the Jesus statue didn't belong. And I guess the best way to think about that is, I mean, it's kind of tough. I don't know where you would think that that didn't belong necessarily. If you knew Frank and you maybe you know that he wasn't a religious person, or maybe you think that he was. Maybe you, I mean, the suicide isn't a suicide, so...
Maybe Harv had just heard that people were transporting drugs in Jesus statues.
That's very likely, which is a big one. Have them transport through the Jesus statues.
But it's nothing. It's something they never explained, and so you just have to believe that Harv has, you know, that sixth sense.
He's the hot-handed god of cops.
Yep.
And he breaks open that Jesus statue and there's a handful of reds.
Before that moment, but it was a great image.
Yeah.
Which I think is the biggest reason it was in the film in the first place. Uh-huh. I mean, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. There's no deeper meaning. But when Robert Blake first shows up to pick him up at the bar,
yeah,
it's interesting, the interaction between Harv and his peers.
Yeah, exactly. He kind of tells them all like it, how it is, and introduces them to...
Well, you can tell that they don't really... They're maybe a little...
They're weary of him on a level. They get that he's full of shit for the most part, or on some level.
Yep. But none of them challenge him.
Not really, no. You just don't. It's like you have that with friends, you know? Like with you. When I know you're full of shit, I sometimes just let you go. I let you talk.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Not always. Sometimes no. I gotta reel you in.
That's okay.
Sometimes I gotta be your wintergreen to my Harv. I don't know, whatever. Anyway,
So you're Harv.
Yeah, I'm Harv.
So I can go three times.
You can go three times. I can't go in the morning at all.
Well, that's a fucking shame.
That's a horse of a different color. So basically they go to this hippie commune and Wintergreen tries to do the, hey, I'm a cop. I'm looking for this guy. Have you seen him? And everyone's just kind of like...
Community of relations.
Blank faced, like, no. And you're like, they probably are all just giving me the runaround. But, you know, what's Wintergreen supposed to do in that circumstance?
He's supposed to break heads.
He's supposed to bust some heads, break some kidneys. And he
no,
kind of...
You wouldn't have to go to that length. You don't have to...
No.
You just tell him, you know, I'm investigating a murder.
Use words,
this
yeah.
is no joke.
Mm-hmm.
A man is dead. I'm going to get the information I want. And you can either cooperate and give me something to go on, or I'm going to have to call up a whole bunch more cops. We're going to have to come down here. We're going to have to roust you. We're going to have to run you for warrants. We're going to have to sniff for drugs.
We're going
to
jam you
and
up
do
good.
Do you want to deal with all that? Because ultimately, I don't give a shit one way or the other. I'm just trying to solve my murder. And either you can cooperate and help me out, and you'll serve yourselves the best.
Yeah.
Or you can be dickheads. And the choice is up to you.
Yeah, do you want to get jammed up or not, you know?
Jammed up, that's a good word for it.
That's what they use. And Harv's not that way, though. Harv's not as diplomatic as you. Harv comes out and he's like,
it's
I'll
not
hit
a matter of diplomacy. It's a matter of...
Efficiency.
Of results.
Exactly. I agree. I'm much more results attached. I think Harv over tipped... They tip their hat, sort of, at this point. Not their hat, but they tip their hand.
As soon as he dumped the bullets out on the ground, I'm like, the guy's a jack-off.
Yeah, as soon as he jumped the bullets on the ground, you're like, well, is this a negotiating tool? And where's he going to go with this? Who's he going to hit first? And how is that going to be instigated? And there really was no instigation, so you're like, okay, Harv is going to bully some guys into getting the information that maybe he needs.
Yeah, they're lucky.
And really, they didn't have much. I mean, this chick just kind of comes out and says, look, I know him, you know, because she thinks he's going to crack a couple more skulls.
And she was a cutie, too.
A little bit.
A little hippie.
Yeah, for 70s. And,
which there was supposed to be a romantic interest, I'm assuming, between her and Robert Blake.
Maybe just Blake being more yammery, but yeah.
More yammery.
But well, there's that little one that happens where he's at the ice cream, or he's at the food truck.
That was kind of funny, too, and that... And I think that was just a matter of humor, but it was...
Yeah.
Especially... especially because the two women were quite a bit taller than he was.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's just, you know...
He's
flirting like hell. He made it work.
He made it work, and, I mean, it's interesting because it shows he's kind of a womanizer on a level. Because he's with that other woman at the beginning, and you never really know...
Yeah, but that's not
what
serious.
You never get a sense of how it is, how serious it is or isn't. I don't know. Maybe I'm too old school. and I see...
You never get the impression that he's married or has a family.
Yeah, if I see two people wake up together, I think it's somewhat serious, but maybe not. So Harv brings in this woman and gets almost no real information out of her, except that this guy they're looking for is up north, so they put an all-points bulletin out on him, and that's that.
Bolo.
Yeah. And, you know, at this point, then, is when we have the interaction with the girlfriend of Harv, I guess, who...
That was just...
Is the woman that Big John was banging at the beginning of the movie, and so we're like, oh, okay.
Again, another... He seems to go after the tall ones.
Well, if you're that short... Tall chicks are hot, though. I mean, like, come on. Not like as a rule, but just like it helps.
Because their legs are longer?
Sure.
Not if they're like Sasquatch.
Well, I didn't mean Sasquatch.
I mean, if they're big boned.
Yeah, I didn't mean... I'm not talking about some kind of a fucking...
If they can, like, throw you over their
shoulder. I'm not talking about a lummox that can, like, throw 50 stone. Anywho.
There's someone for everyone.
And then this scene is kind of this long, like, feels like something out of a Tennessee Williams play about it, where a drunk woman talks about the... Sort of
it really does.
Lost her lost hopes and dreams and settling for this cop that thinks he knows everything.
But it was also...
It's a way to deconstruct Harv a little bit. And it's also
another story of somebody else.
Yeah.
Whose dreams weren't realized.
Mm-hmm. So she cuts Harv to the quick and at the time creates a rift between Harv and Big John by basically...
The rift was already grown.
Yeah. It was starting to, but it becomes apparent now because basically she's like, yeah, I was banging you too, John, right? And then Harv didn't know this, and Harv's like, oh my gosh, you were banging my girl? That sucks. I guess you're not going to be my driver anymore. That's not the language they use, obviously. But
just don't tell anyone.
Yeah, just don't tell anyone. I'll fucking kill you! So Harv is pretty much in a state of pretty much of patheticness.
Yeah, pretty much, but she also sort of insinuated that she banged lots of guys.
Yeah, she was a slut.
She had some self-esteem issues.
Well, so what? Anyway, so, you know, old Big John's back on the...
she just wanted to be a
back on the electric glide with...
back on the elephant.
With Zipper, just talking about comic books, not wanting
and
to talk about comic books.
And
they
go. Another mystery is that he seems to get little John to pay, or Big John to pay for him, too.
Yeah, Big John pays for stuff for him sometimes. And so then they see this group of co-cutters just driving down along the road, and they're like, hey, let's go check those guys out.
And if you can see this in parentheses above his head, mm-hmm. that means a motorcycle gang.
Yeah, well, motorcycle gang, yeah.
It's sort of a pussy, hippie motorcycle gang.
But a motorcycle gang nonetheless.
More of like a convoy.
Convoy.
Okay.
And as they're going to chase him down, just to check him out. They didn't have their lights on him, I don't think. They were just following behind him to see what was going on. Just see if there was anything going. Big John notices that one of the guys in the motorcycle gang is the guy they're looking for. Is this this guy that the woman said went up north and that they were looking for at the hippie commune and everything. So then it becomes a motorcycle chase, which is awesome and results in all kinds of carnage and violence and people's heads getting run over and shit like that.
Yeah, that was really kind of odd, too.
And then they bring in... But Big John catches this guy. So him and Harv are going through
after
some interrogation.
After he starts another rift with his buddy.
Yeah.
Zipper.
Yeah, Zipper's trying to shoot him dead from his motorcycle. And so Big John's like, he wants the collar, he wants the case. Now, maybe he wants it for his career, or maybe he wants it because he wants to solve the problem.
I think he's kind of given up at that point.
Well, then there you go, then. His motivations are just and justified, then, in terms of him wanting to catch the guy for real, to get at something for solving this crime. So then they bring him into the interrogation, this guy they caught, and old Harv's basically saying, I'm going to bust you up, I'm pretty sure you did this, we got your fingerprints in the space. Which is circumstantial, but, you know, there you go. And you had money on you. You had $3,700 on you.
$5,000 was... A lot of times, circumstantial evidence is your best evidence.
Of course.
It's better than...
Yeah. But there was $5,000 missing from Frank, who's the guy who was murdered at the beginning's shack. That's another thing. I don't know if they mentioned that.
Which they heard from the crazy guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's never been substantiated that it actually exists.
Well, but the crazy guy had some sort of a like long-standing relationship with Frank, so we get a sense that in whatever way that was, he wouldn't really be too full of it, but who knows? He would just make up.
Yeah, but he's
like
kind of a nut, so $5 could be $5,000.
Possibly,
like,
yeah.
Rain Man, how much does a compact car cost? About $100.
Yeah, exactly.
How much does a candy bar cost? About $100.
Exactly.
But, I mean, so it, there's just a little bit. It's not set in stone.
No, no, it's not. It's not. It's not. And so old Wintergreen goes out, and then he's working at the concert, the Hippie Jam concert, where all the cops
have to bring up one thing that really hints of Zebko's guilt is he's found with $3,700.
Yeah, I mentioned that. And then that's what led me to talk about the $5,000.
Okay, sorry.
And then, so he's working at the at this hippie concert, jam festival, whatever.
Jam band.
Just doing security, being a good cop, despite what
keeping
everybody else said.
Keeping people off the stage.
Yeah, doing good for community relations. And after the fact, he's sitting there just kind of yammering with the janitor who's cleaning up, having his lunch.
The poor janitor's just trying to use his fucking sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. And it comes to him that he realizes, he comes to a motivation based on the advice of, or the original sort of scholarly wisdom of Harv from early on about listening to yourself and, you know, all that other stuff. He listens to himself and he thinks through the case and the motivations potentially for who might have done what. And he comes to the conclusion that old Eli, what's his name? The crazy guy. I lost. Elijah Willie. Cook. That Elijah Cook.
Willie,
who, that's his character name, is probably the one who did it. So he goes and he talks to him, and he talks to him real nice, like, you know, because he knows that he's not all there. And he says, you know, just tell us what's going on here. And that's the conclusion, pretty much, is that Elijah Cook did it, and Elijah Cook killed his friend because he was lonely because his friend had been alienated from him because
he started hanging
out with young kids, and he had become a dope dealer and all that other stuff, selling these reds, these barbiturates that they kept in the Jesus statues. So that was that. And
phenobarbital.
Yeah. And Big John has a chance to give the other cop a piece of his mind and tell him, hey, you know, you were wrong. You were full of shit. You beat up those kids for no reason and all this stuff that you did as this, like, overstepping fascist authoritarian figure was completely not, I mean, the results didn't justify it. Not that that alone would justify it, but, you know, the conclusion, the ends did not come to what you were, you know, pushing for. So, you know, you're not so great, Harv. And that kind of gives him his closure. And at that point, the movie ends. But then the movie doesn't end, because then there's another scene. He goes to visit Zipper, his partner, the other bicycle cop.
After he'd solved the murder.
And Zipper's had a couple of drinks, and Zipper's all excited, and he unveils that he's got this kick-ass motorcycle that he had talked about earlier. That was his dream, was to get a kick-ass motorcycle. And Blake looks at it, and for a minute there, he's excited for him, and then he realizes, uh-oh, you took the $5,000 from the crime scene. But this guy then all of a sudden crashes. He all of a sudden goes from being elated about his new motorcycle.
He knows how
it's going
to
go.
Robert Blake is, and he knows Robert Blake's going to have to
PPP
follow, go by the book.
And then it's going to be the end for him. He's not going to be able to have his fun times, ride his motorcycle, busting.
And really,
hippies.
You have to. It's not right. But really sent it over was not the money so much, but the fact that he was willing to let this guy,
the other guy, go. Yeah, the hippie. He was going to let him, and that's usually the big deal. That's the big problem with obstruction issues. That's why it's so important to not have that stuff happen. Because somebody else gets blamed and things go down, and it's like, if you could have prevented that, that's a big deal. And so then he commits a copicide, basically.
Yeah, that was pretty strange.
Blake has to shoot his partner down, and that sucks for him.
Yeah, that was a bummer.
And then he has his reflective moment being part of the world, part of the landscape that he travels. And then he's scoping things out, and he sees the hippie bus again.
Without realizing,
Not necessarily, yeah. I mean, you know, but he's been through a lot that month, you know? Yeah. And so he pulls the guy over and for not having a front bumper, and then, which is...
That's not why he pulled him over.
Yeah, but he notices he doesn't have a front bumper, but then he notices who the guy is, and he's like, you know what?
And you know the interesting part of all this? Never would have happened if Zipper was still alive. If it'd still been alive.
That's a good point. Yeah, if Zipper had been with him, then the end...
Things would have gotten a lot different.
The conclusion would have been somewhat different. But Blake realizes that this is the guy that they kind of hassled before, and he's like, you know what, I owe you one. Which is very un-him, if you think about his character from the beginning.
No, I think in a way...
In the beginning, he was going to give people crap if they fucked things up and if they continued to just to do it. He wasn't really... You didn't get the sense that he
tried to be fair. Yeah, that was the whole thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily that he was nice.
No.
He was just fair.
And so he was
fair.
And
this guy got busted for something...
Well, he didn't get busted.
He didn't do. Yeah, he did. They busted him.
Oh, for the drugs?
For the drugs.
Oh, that's right.
And he wasn't guilty of it.
That's true.
And in Robert Blake's mind, he was owed one.
Yeah.
He got a freebie.
So he gave him a freebie and said, okay, be off. But then at the last minute, as the guy's down the road, Blake realizes, oh shit, I've still got your license. Because, you know, he took his license to look at it. So he goes to try and catch up with them. And then, spoiler alert, the window comes down to the back, and in very much so, like, reminiscent of...
Well, we have to mention first, when he pulls the guy over, the first time he was pulled over, this hippie dude...
Was alone.
Was by himself. Second time, he's got this fatter Manson-looking dude with him.
Yeah, who you can tell, because...
It's a little more ominous-looking.
Yeah, it's more ominous, and there's something else going on. There's like, oh man, I'm all up on something. It's like, whatever, they're worried, because the hippies are talking earlier, before the cop gets to him. And so Blake's chasing him down, trying to, you know, give
and
him...
And the guy gives him the great advice to sweet talk him.
Yeah. Give him, you know, he's trying to give him a friendly, like, hey, you know, like, he's not trying to, you know, pull him over. He's just trying to get it, let him know, hey, I've got, you know, just like a very friendly, like, hey, I've got your license still. The window comes down, shotgun comes out, we're doing Easy Rider, boom. So, similar to the ending of Easy Rider, shotgun, somebody gets shot and off a motorcycle.
Yeah, it was a shotgun, too.
And the way he just falls and lands there, and then it just keeps pulling back, and it pulls back like for a long time. And because the director was a composer, there's music going the whole time, and it's a very big, beautiful
right,
sound.
Right, he wrote the score.
Landscape shot and all that, very John Ford. And that's sort of the end, and it's sort of like the point is... It's like you said, it's another bit of nihilistic aspect to it. But it does show, hey, this guy lived by his principles. He tried to be a good guy.
Ultimately, it's a good movie and you should see it because...
Well, hopefully you have because we spoiled the ending. But yeah, I'd give it a... I'd give it a B+. It's not perfect, but it's economical in its structure. And it's thought-provoking.
For the time period, I'd give it an A.
I can't do that. I can't do that for the time period. I have to assess it for what it is.
That's not fair. It's kind of like box office numbers.
No. But box office numbers, then you look at... That's by the numbers. But for this, I'm looking... and so I give it high points for the cinematography, the duality of the cinematography. And I give it high points for the economic structure of the story. I give it high points for not being such a simple cookie-cutter bunch of characters and everything. But, I mean, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good.
Solo.
I'm just trying to figure out if there's any way we can bring Tone Loc into this conversation, but I can't figure it out. But you were talking about...
Well, he was doing the wild thing at the beginning.
Could have been.